Good morning. My name is Andrew Weimer, and I'm a student here at Southern. Today's presentation is on Margaret Clarkson. This is from a presentation which I gave at the Hymn Society of the United States of Canada's annual conference in St. Olaf this past July, which was titled The Legacy of E. Margaret Clarkson, FHS. You will notice that I print out some handouts, and hopefully you were able to grab one of those. Everybody grab one of those. We'll reference these. This is just for you to be able to look at Margaret's poetry and hymns and to interact with that as we mention certain hymns. Just a word about my sources. There's very little out on Margaret's life. Two of her books contain autobiographical chapters, but that is very limited. Most of the resources that I employed were from the archives at Wheaton, where her papers are preserved. Margaret is an interesting person because her name is very recognizable in hymnological circles, and yet very few people know very much about her. I encountered this as I was preparing a paper for a class 2 years ago, and I talked to many scholars, and all of them knew Margaret well and loved her hymns, but really could not tell me much about her. And so that inspired me to begin a deeper study of Margaret's hymns. We're going to talk about Margaret's life, and then at the end we will talk briefly about her legacy, and if we have time we'll take any questions or comments that anyone has. Another thing is that suffering was a major part of Margaret's life. If I were to recount all of the surgeries and the minutiae of all her suffering, that's all this lecture would be about. So I've somewhat minimized that to focus on the rest of her life, but just know that suffering was a huge part of Margaret's life, and we will talk some about that. Also, we're going to have some pictures up here. There are not very many existing pictures of Margaret. She had very shallow relationships with her family, and so her very few limited pictures that she had personally of herself are the ones that are in the archives at Wheaton. Otherwise, there's no other existing pictures of her. Let's get started. Though self-taught, Margaret Clarkson published over 100 hymns, and she became an influential voice in North American hymnody later in her life. By birth, she was a Canadian, yet her texts were widely published in the United States, bringing a degree of literary excellence to evangelical hymnody, which had really been absent beforehand. Her role as a female writer was uncommon during the early part of the 20th century. She was a female writer when it was not popular to be one. The Hymn Society of the United States and Canada recognized her for her work in hymnology, in hymnody, and named her a Fellow of the Hymn Society, which is the highest honor they bestow. They named her that in 1992. Margaret died in 2008, and that's what originally spurred this lecture. Was a chance to remember her life and legacy. Margaret was born on June 4th, 1915, in Melville, Saskatchewan, to Frederick and Ethel Clarkson. Margaret, as she was known, she never liked her first name, Edith. She preferred Margaret. She was the third of five children. Her father, Frederick, was an Irish immigrant. He had been raised in England and claimed to have run away from home when he was 14. He later made his way to Ontario, Canada, and he met Ethel May Brown, a Canadian of English and Scottish descent. They were married 6 weeks after meeting, and their marriage proved to be a very unhappy and bitter experience for Margaret. She recalled very vividly her father's prolonged absences and the tension of the marital problems in her household, and this was a very traumatic experience for her, which really helped to, it really shaped the rest of her life. She was, for the most part, led a very lonely life. She was single her whole life, and so this was really the beginning. From birth, she was very lonely, as her parents were constantly involved in fighting and really did not have much time for her. Margaret's health was poor from infancy. Her first words her mother told her were, "My head hurts," and she had intense headaches and convulsive vomiting. This is something she struggled with her whole life. Fits of vomiting that would last from 24 to 48 hours, which all she could do was just hope and pray for it to end. This wreaked havoc on her body. Though it went undiagnosed at the time, Margaret had a spinal... it was malformed at birth, and so this created all kinds of arthritic problems in her body. However, at an early age, arthritis was not a major part. She did have some juvenile arthritis for a few years, but that really set in later on in her life. Margaret wrote this of her third year. "When I was 3 years old, I spent most of a year in bed with what is known as juvenile arthritis. I can still remember the pain, the sleepless nights, the inability to move without screaming, the bald spot worn on the back of my head after I lay so long in bed. I had to learn to walk all over again when I recovered. A second arthritic attack when I was 12 settled in one arm, leaving my wrist and hand swollen and partly crippled for several years." That juvenile arthritis eventually disappeared, no longer was a problem, but it would come back later in her life. At the age of 4, her parents moved to Toronto, the town in which Margaret would spend most of the rest of her life. At this time, her family began attending St. John's Presbyterian Church in Toronto. Margaret would later say that her years at St. John's were theologically the most formative years of her life. And this is where she picked up her conservative Reformed theology. She was a dedicated Presbyterian her whole life. And that really permeates her texts, her hymn texts, and her writings, her devotional writings. It was here that Margaret was exposed to the Westminster Shorter Catechism. She had that memorized by the age of 11. And also here, she attended missions band. And this is a very interesting facet of Margaret's life. She was a Presbyterian who... At the end of her life, she looked back and she was just confounded by how many hymns she'd written on missions. And she credited that in a large part to her time at the missions band in St. John's Church. One of the great contributions St. John's made to shaping Margaret's hymnody is she was exposed to substantive historical hymnody, like Wesley, Watts. She became a huge fan of the Wesleys, of Cooper, of Newton. She quickly learned to love these hymn writers, and at an early age, she learned to judge hymns by the scriptural truths they contained within them. And Margaret said that she was converted at the age of 10 due to the ministry of St. John's. From her early childhood, Margaret loved words. She remembered spending hours on end playing with words and organizing them into phrases. She loved sitting in trees. She'd climb up a tree and sit for hours. She had no mobility, very little mobility. She could not play with children her age, so she learned to amuse herself, and she used words to do this and books. In 1925, the same year her parents divorced, she spontaneously decided to jot down her first poem and entered it into a poetry competition for children under the age of 16. If you look on your handout, you'll see what I believe is this poem, her first poem, The New Year, on the first page. She was surprised and delighted when she won second place. She went and showed her mom, and her mom had no idea that she had this gift and was completely astounded. From this point on, Margaret was active writing poetry. Much of her early poetry is archived at Wheaton. It was never published. It is somewhat juvenile in topic, but she also did publish she did write some hymns, and she had a decent grasp of form and of words. If you look on your handout, you see the birthday of the king. Margaret wrote this when she was 12. In 1927, this was the first hymn of hers, which I've been able to locate. It is a hymn on the Advent. This is a big theme in Margaret's hymns. Yet, very few of her hymns on the birth of Christ are published. There's only one that I know of that's in a hymnal. Also, during Margaret's 12th year, the same year she wrote The Birthday of the King and many other poems and hymns, she learned to play the piano, and she used the hymnal as her instructor. She taught herself how to play the piano. And so she began to see how text and music interact with each other. At the age of 13, Margaret's family moved from St. John's to a non-denominational church with a revivalist tradition. She was exposed to gospel songs for the first time. She appreciated these songs and enjoyed these songs, yet to her they did not compare to the hymnody which she had been exposed to at St. John's. She called them fluffy and light, and it was at this time her pastor asked her to write her first song for the congregation, and I do not have that song. I can't locate which one it was. And also, there's some discrepancy. Margaret said at the age of 13 she was asked to write her first hymn, and yet in her manuscripts, The Birthday of the King, she put the date 1927, when she could have turned 13. But there's some discrepancies between the dates, so I can't speak with any certainty to which hymn that was. Margaret attended Riverdale Collegiate Institute in Toronto, but in 1933 she was forced to drop out for health reasons. After taking a year off, she completed her teacher's certification at Toronto's Teachers College. Since at this time the North American economy was reeling from the Great Depression, Margaret could not find any jobs, and she was forced to look very far away from her home, way out in the boonies of Canada. She was in the Rainy River District in Northern Ontario, and I drove through Northern Ontario about 50 miles from where her Kirkland Lake, where she spent most of her time, and it is a desolate and very isolated region. She took a job as a teacher in the Rainy River District, and in 1937, after two years, she moved to the Kirkland Lake, which is a remote gold mining town. She taught there for 5 years. During this time, Margaret faced the most difficult time of her life. She was isolated emotionally. She had very few friends in Kirkland Lake. She was isolated spiritually. There was no church that she could attend, I believe she said, Bible-proclaiming church that she could attend. And so she was very isolated. What kept her going were letters from her parents, which were very rare, but she also had letters from a couple in her church that kind of stepped in and acted as her parents and discipled her and encouraged her. And this really kept her going. The lady's name was Ethel Leggett, and she proved to be a very influential lady in Margaret's life. It was in this time that Margaret wrote So Send I You, which you'll find in your handout. You also notice the hymn on top of that is Trials. I just included this to show you. Margaret wrote this when she was 14. I included this just to show you the material in this hymn is very deep spiritually. And Margaret was forced to mature a lot faster than most children because of the extreme difficulties she faced with her health. And also, she was very sharp theologically, as far as I can tell, at this age. So that would also help explain the depth of this hymn. You'll notice also that she used archaic language in Trials, and this characterized her hymns until about the 1960s, when she decided to convert her hymns to what she called contemporary language. So Send I You to Labor Unrewarded. You see that right there. This was a dark time in Margaret's life, as I already said. She faced thoughts of suicide. She was greatly depressed. In this So Send I You is very dark. It reflects a darker side and slightly pessimistic. It's very true, yet it reflects a slightly more negative view of Christian ministry, suffering with Christ, and not the full scope of the joy of Christian ministry. In 1962, she would rewrite that hymn. You can see So Send I You, By Grace Made Strong to Triumph, on the next page over in your handout. And that reflected, as we'll talk about, she had a period of intense spiritual maturation, and this hymn reflects her new perspective on Christian ministry and the Christian life. She talks about that period with fondness, that period of spiritual growth, and this occurred sometime in the 50s, as far as I can tell. She never really puts a date on it, but she really began to get into God's Word and became very grounded in her theology. This is when you'll begin to see her understanding of God's sovereignty emerge in her hymns. Margaret had never owned a home before, but in 1941 she purchased a cottage on the Severn River in Ontario. She purchased it for $600. That was her annual salary. The cottage was only accessible by boat, and Margaret was very handicapped. There were times when she was stranded at her cottage for a week or two just because she couldn't even operate the boat motor. So this was, she loved this place. It was where she did most of her later writing of hymns. It is interesting that she was able to maintain it with her physically handicapped condition. Here she learned to birdwatch. She learned to become a homemaker. Margaret had been in a broken home, and so she'd never really learned what it meant to be a homemaker. And she said this was very helpful with her in coming to grips with her sexuality as a single female. Having this home it was greatly encouraging to her, and it also helped her to create a sense of permanence. She reflected on this. Up to this point, she'd been sort of a nomad, and yet here she put down roots, and she lived here for quite a long time. She sold the cottage in 1980, I believe, when she became physically unable to keep it up. The shortage of manpower in World War II made it possible for Margaret to come out of exile in Northern Ontario and come back to closer to home in Toronto and to get a job. She worked for the Toronto Board of Education, and in 1944, she published her first book, Let's Listen to Music. This book was a music appreciation book, and it stayed in print for 22 years. In 1991 interview, Margaret credited her inspiration for this book as her hefty mortgage payment. Margaret loved to write, but financially she was at times almost forced to write to make ends meet. Upon her return to Toronto, Margaret began attending Knox Presbyterian Church. Here she would meet Dr. Fitch, William Fitch, who became very influential in her life. Nobody knew this at the time, but Margaret had a very close relationship with Dr. Fitch. What they did was, for propriety's sake, they only talked on the phone, and they would talk for hours. Dr. Fitch's wife knew about this and encouraged him to do this, and it was a large source of encouragement and discipleship for Margaret. It's just very interesting. They did not want anyone to spread rumors in the church since she was a single lady. So nobody really knew about it in the church. She partially credits him for helping her with her understanding of God as sovereign, which had just come to permeate a lot of her texts. In 1946, she published her first hymn, We Come, O Christ, to Thee. I've included that in your handout. She later changed it to We Come, O Christ, to You, updated the language. I included that version on your handout instead of the version with the archaic language. So it was published in the first hymnal for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship. And this really began a professional relationship Margaret had, and she found it very profitable spiritually as well. She loved to go hang out with the college kids at InterVarsity Christian Fellowship, but she became very involved in writing hymns for InterVarsity Christian Fellowship in America. In 1948, she took an editorial position at Wheaton College, but she returned to Toronto almost immediately thereafter. She spent a few months in Wheaton, and she never recorded why she left. It's somewhat of a mystery what went on there. I've heard one person who knew Margaret conjectured that she was just homesick for Toronto. In 1960, she published her third book, Susie's Babies. It became a very popular sex education method using hamsters. It was really the first Christian sex education manual, and so it came at a time when the sexual revolution of the 60s, 50s, 60s, and so it became very popular with Christians, as it was a appropriate way to share with their children. And Billy Graham's wife wrote the foreword to this book. Because that book was such a huge success, Margaret was able to take a year off and study. She enrolled at the University of Toronto. And during that whole decade, Margaret published seven books. But while she was at the University of Toronto, it's kind of funny, Margaret was very competitive. Some of her former students were in the same college classes that she was taking, and so she made a point of always having better grades than all of them, and she had to work very hard for that. In 1968, Margaret underwent spinal fusion surgery. It was the most extensive surgery which she had to undergo up to that point. It limited her movement even further, so it further handicapped her. She spent a great deal of time on a Stryker bed, which she called it an ancient torture device. But it was a very miserable time for her, very, very trying. And then she went home, and since she was single and she had no close family, she had to rehabilitate herself. And that took quite a few months. In 1972, Margaret published her book, Grace Grows Best in Winter. This book dealt with human suffering and God's sovereignty. It shared her experience with suffering and pain. This book is interesting because it became very influential in the life of Johnny Erickson Tada, who was in her hospital bed, and one of her friends brought this book and used it in discipling her and encouraging her. And Margaret and Johnny they had a very close friendship for the rest of Margaret's life, and it's very interesting at Wheaton, there's the correspondence between the two of them, and they were very good friends, and they shared a bond, an understanding of in suffering that I don't think Margaret shared with many people. Margaret retired from teaching in 1973 after 38 years. During her retirement, she took intermittent courses at Regent College in British Columbia, and she also taught Christian hymnody courses there. She attended lectures at Ontario Bible College and Theological Seminary in Toronto, and I think this helped to keep her young and being around. She loved to be around college students, graduate students. She published Conversations with a Barred Owl in 1975, and this reflected Margaret's love of nature. You can see this in some of her hymns. She had an affinity for nature, and she loved to write about it. It's very fun to read these books. They are very practical, very simple, and enjoyable. In 1978, she published So You're Single. She shared her wisdom and knowledge regarding the gift of singleness. She was quite open about her struggles and victories with singleness. She really looked back on her life at this juncture and acknowledged that she probably wouldn't have not been able to function as a wife. And so she was very at peace with her singleness. And, she looked at it within the scope of God's sovereignty and knew that he had ordained it that way. In 1982, Margaret was able to fulfill a lifelong dream when she visited England. In her 1982 Christmas letter, she recounted being overcome with tears over the graves of the Wesleys and Watts and Bunyan. By this time, her knees had made her rather immobile, and so she carried a lawn chair with her whenever she walked through London, so she could just sit down whenever she needed to rest, and so she recounts that, and it's kind of humorous in some of her Christmas letters. And it was actually on this visit that Margaret is the first time she ever interacted with other hymn writers. So Margaret spent the majority of her life as a loner, a very unique hymn writer who was influenced primarily by Wesley, Watts, Cooper, Newton, Bunyan. In the early 70s, Margaret went back. She was in the 60s, late 60s, early 70s. She went back and altered those for hymns which contained archaic language. You'll see We Come, O Christ, to Thee as an example of that. She felt that it was necessary that her hymns reflect the changes which were occurring in biblical language with the emergence of a lot of new Bible translations. She also took, and this is something which she's not very well known for, but in several hymnals she went back and edited several older hymns from English writers. She edited Come Thou Fount, among other hymns, and that's not something which she's very well known for, but she was passionate about bringing hymns into the contemporary language. In 1983, she published another book on suffering, which was Destined for Glory. And in 1985, she had major knee replacement surgery, which went horribly wrong. I think it was Johnson & Johnson's, which made this knee, this artificial knee, and she ended up being stuck with this malfunctioning knee replacement, and she sent them a very fiery, feisty letter, which was several pages long, and complained about the problems she was having, and they ended up settling with her, which really helped her financially in her retirement. During her last few years, Margaret was hoping, she really desired to write an autobiography, but she was not able to, just due to the fact of her arthritis. She could not type. It's interesting, as you spend time in the archives, as I spend time, you can see her typing deteriorate. And eventually, her last few things which she typed up, it's very almost hard to read because the typing was so poor, and that was due to her arthritis. And she had all this writing which she wanted to accomplish, both of hymns and books, and yet she was not able to do it. During an interview in 1991, Margaret said that her primary goal in life was not to get into a nursing home. However, in 1992, after Margaret was named a fellow of the Hymn Society, she had to retire to a nursing home in Toronto. She outlived all of her siblings and most of her close friends. Margaret suffered from dementia in the latter years of her life, and in 2008, Margaret went to be with the Lord. I do want to highlight some themes from Margaret's life. I think the biggest theme that you can see in Margaret's hymns and in her writing is hope. I think that her life very well could have been defined by suffering, and that could have been the end of the story. Yet her books and hymns and articles, they all leave behind a testimony of hope and faith in a sovereign God. A very few of Margaret's hymns do not mention suffering and trial, but what is interesting is they almost always mention it as a secondary thematic element. And this is just because her life was full of pain and struggle. She was born into an unhappy family and experienced the loneliness of singleness. Extreme physical pain was a reality for her, and she was barely able to hold a job. The fact that Margaret taught for 38 years is very remarkable. Because of her physical health. Her understanding of the Word allowed her to realize that God was faithful and he could use these situations to work his will. Within Margaret's hymns, human trial serves as a stepping stone to expressions of hope and faith and praise to God. In a sense, Margaret follows the pattern of the psalmist who lament their ills and then conclude in praising God. This is evident in much of her devotional writing. Her books and pretty much all of her writings, they reflect a gritty determination and the harrowing stories that she experienced throughout her life. Yet her focus was on God's grace and God's sovereignty for almost all the time, almost all the things I have read. At this point, let me just say, it's very easy to think of Margaret as, to sort of turn her into a saint, Margaret. Margaret was a fallen human being, just like all of the rest of us, and she struggled, sometimes she failed, yet there is this incredible testimony of God's grace and sovereignty. Also, Margaret a woman was. She was single her whole life. She had a very good sense of humor, and she accredited this to her good looks and also to the mass exodus of men during World War II. Pretty much if a man survived, her friends that survived World War II and came back brought European wives back with them to Canada. And so that really eliminated a group of men that where she probably would have found a mate. She never questioned why God would have her to be single. And like we said, she acknowledged that she probably wouldn't have been able to be a very good wife or a mother just because of her physical handicaps. And So You're Single, the book she wrote on singleness, she would later recount her experiences of learning how to function as a single in the church and how she was able to learn to embrace her God-given sexuality outside of a marital relationship. She had to learn how to be fulfilled outside of having a husband, and she found this very difficult in her church setting because the church was crafted for married couples, and so she kind of had to work outside of the box to be fulfilled. During her career, Margaret experienced sexual discrimination. She was a vocal critic of chauvinism in her workplace and in her church. And in an interview later in life, she would recount how she made 60% of, compared to equally qualified males. She had experienced the reality of a male-dominated society of the early to mid 20th century. She questioned the male hierarchy of the church as well, and in her writing, she pressed for changes in the way some churches were run. Margaret was not an anti-feminist, and she was sympathetic to many of the social issues which caused feminism to become very popular. However, she did question much of the feminist movement, specifically in the area of hymnody. She rejected the idea of inclusive language. She thought that was very dangerous. And this is somewhat to be expected because Margaret was very conservative in her theology. And also Margaret was a female hymn writer, and as we said before, she was a female hymn writer at a time in the 20th century when there were very few women writing hymn texts. And this was a large factor in why she was named a fellow of the Hymn Society. As far as Margaret's professional legacy, Margaret was, as we talked about, a teacher for 38 years. And again, her career as a teacher was very not very remarkable, except for the fact that she managed to stay a teacher for 38 years with her health issues. As an author, Margaret was widely published. She was author of educational and devotional material. She authored 17 books, hundreds of poems, music, and many articles on devotional topics. Margaret loved writing, and it was an important and sometimes consuming part of her life. Due to her physical limitations, Margaret once said she could do little that she could not do by writing. Quite a few of her books were published internationally. However, her only works that remain in print today are her hymns. And it's funny, I don't think she ever expected to be as successful of an author as she was. In her Christmas letters, she would recount very proudly and almost with an element of surprise as books were published and if they became successful. And she took a special delight when books were published in other languages, like there were some Christmas letters where she would say, So Your Single was published in Norway, or something along those lines. As a hymnist, Margaret's texts appealed across denominational lines. Margaret was a Presbyterian, but most of her closest professional relationships were with Baptists. And so she really did appeal across denominational lines. Her hymns have appeared in a broad array of hymns, denominational hymnals such as the Catholic hymnals, both in Canada and the United States, and as well as many Protestant hymnals. However, Margaret's hymns are most widely used in non-denominational hymnals. The Hymnal for Worship and Celebration, published in 1986 by Word, and it was edited by Tom Fetke, It contains seven of her texts, while The Worshiping Church, which was published by Hope Publishing, and Don Husted was the editor for that, I believe, it contained 12 of Margaret's hymns, and that was the high water mark of quantity-wise being published in hymnals. Margaret's relationship with Don Husted was a special one. She appreciated his musical treatment of her texts. When he set her texts, she was the one. If she needed somebody to go to, he was the person. She fondly recalled a very special affinity with him, which was notable since she was very, very picky about the settings of her texts. Quite a few of Margaret's works were published through Hope Publishing. She also had a special relationship with Don Wurtzen and Fred Smith. In the preface to A Singing Heart, which was Margaret's last book, it was a collection of her hymns, Don Husted recognized her as a North American hymnist, as opposed to, since she was a native Canadian, and that was really quite true. She appealed across international lines. While she was a native of Canada, Margaret's texts were primarily, they were actually published more in the United States than they were in Canada. Very popular among evangelicals. The part of this can be discounted somewhat because hymnals are published much more frequently in the United States than in Canada. Margaret's texts were marked by literary excellence, which was all the more notable since as a poet and writer she was self-educated. Until 1982, as we talked about, Margaret had not interacted with any other hymn writer. Writing hymns was a very painstaking process for Margaret, both in the sense that she was a perfectionist and a very conscientious writer, but also in the sense that she had severe arthritis, and it was very much a struggle for her. It would most commonly take, her typical creative process would take weeks, months. She would write out a text, throw it in a drawer, let it sit for a while, come back and edit it, throw it in the drawer again, keep editing it until she was pleased with it. However, there's one exception. You'll find this in your handout, Lord of the Universe, Hope of the World. This is an example of when Margaret did have this sort of an inspirational moment where she just jotted down a hymn in the matter of a few minutes or hours. This was written for the 1973 Urbana Conference, which is with University Christian Fellowship. This is an aberration from her typical creative process, but this was she considered this the high point of her writing career, writing this hymn and then going and hearing it sung at the conference. Margaret's literary excellence set her apart from other 20th century writers in the evangelical tradition. Don Husted recognized her as the one evangelical hymn writer of the 20th century. The one excellent evangelical hymn writer of the 20th century, which is very, very profound praise. Placing Margaret within a particular genre is very difficult for a variety of reasons. She was self-taught as a hymnist, so she was primarily influenced by what she learned from historical hymnody. Some of the most influential people in her life, not just as authors, but also spiritually, were men such as Wesley and Watts. Margaret was very isolated from the hymnological community, which also makes it hard to place her. Another difficult reason is that Margaret's formative religious experience was split between two traditions. She went to St. John's, where she learned historical hymnody, and then she went to a non-denominational church where she sang primarily gospel songs. I think this exposure to both traditions is reflected in, if you were to look through her compilation of texts in A Singing Heart, in that she wrote songs like Jesus Set My Soul A-Singing and Go Tell, Go Tell, which are clearly more in the gospel song tradition. And then she also used missions, which it was a very large theme in her hymns, which would also tend to point more toward the gospel song tradition. However, then you have texts such as the ones we have looked at, like Lord of the Universe, Hope of the World, and O Father, You Are Sovereign, which are more, I guess I would say, classically conceived in nature. There are varied opinions held by scholars about Margaret's placement in a particular genre or hymn movement. Some scholars view Margaret as a sort of a member of the New British Renaissance or the Hymn Explosion movement. I would point out that there are some weaknesses to this view. Chronologically, Margaret's productive time as a hymn writer preceded that movement, and she did not really interact with anyone in that movement until 1982. And even the hymns of hers, which tend to reflect themes of that would have been popular in the New British Renaissance or the Hymn Explosion movement, they reflect the same overarching theme, but she writes her hymn with a much different tone and a much different focus than I would say is found in most New British Renaissance or the Hymn Explosion hymns. And I think there's some other literary elements that would point to Margaret not being within that particular genre. Another opinion is that Margaret is within the gospel song tradition and gospel hymnody, and just that she brought to gospel hymnody a degree of excellence which hitherto had been absent. I think this opinion is probably the most plausible. It is, you know, the ramifications of that are quite large. One scholar I've talked to looked at Margaret as a successor of Fanny Crosby, looked at her, I talked to a scholar who looked at her as the culmination of the gospel song movement. She brought a degree of literary excellence that had not been present within the gospel song genre. Now, this is also interesting, though, because this is complicated, because Margaret herself would not have placed her with she would not have placed herself in the gospel song genre. She looked at herself as independent from that. And so whether she gets a say or not, I'm not sure. Well, this may become clearer over time. The discussion will continue, and it should become more apparent. Margaret was very unique in hymnody. She was a Presbyterian who emphasized missions to almost an extreme. And she was a Canadian who was more popular in America. And there's a lot of very unique things about Margaret. I think it suffices to say that she was a conservative evangelical writer. I think for now that is saying enough. During the 1980s, she became more involved with the world of hymnology. She spoke on hymnody. She promoted excellence in hymn writing, both in articles and in her books. She was involved in co-judging several hymn competitions for the Hymn Society, and this was a role she took very seriously. And I was somewhat shocked as I was reading through her correspondence. She insisted on promoting literary excellence to the point of sometimes it seemed if she might have estranged herself from the committee. She was made a fellow of the Hymn Society in 1991, which again is the highest honor you can have, be awarded by the Hymn Society of the United States and Canada. Through Margaret's hymns and devotional books, articles, we can see Margaret's hope and faith due to her intense suffering, her unique personal experiences, and her theology. Her contributions to hymnody are very unique. Her texts on the sovereignty of God are rare treatments of the topic as a primary theme. As you see in O Father, You Are Sovereign, that's one of the very few hymns which clearly delineates the doctrine of sovereignty. Her literary excellence as a conservative evangelical was very rare for the 20th century, especially if you view her within the gospel song tradition. Margaret Clarkson never intended to become a writer, and she never intended, much less, to become a hymn writer. Sprinkled throughout her diaries and correspondence, one can find sort of an element of surprise that people actually used her texts and found them spiritually profitable, and I think that really delighted her. While she never aspired to be a writer, writing for Margaret became sort of compulsory. She had to write. She found it in it a remarkable way to fulfill herself and to serve God and the church. As an author, her writing, specifically her hymns, will be the works for which she is primarily remembered. Finally, human suffering was a dominant theme within Margaret's hymns. However, as we pointed out, it was a secondary theme, which served as a stepping stone to expressions of praise of God, exhortation of believers, and proclamation of God's truth. Such was Margaret's life. Human suffering was the context for all that she did and wrote, yet her life was an intense testimony to the faith and hope in a living God. One other thing I'd like to talk about as we work our concluding is the use of Margaret's texts. They seem to be, it's hard to tell whether there's abiding popularity, abiding use. In some Canadian hymnals, Margaret is still has a significant amount of recent Canadian hymnals. She still has a significant amount of her texts being published. Yet within like the New Baptist Southern Baptist hymnal, I don't believe there is a song by her, a hymn by her. So Margaret's legacy: she was a conservative evangelical writer whose writings appealed across denominational and international lines. She was unique in her literary excellence. She had a passion for missions and service, and this pervaded her texts. She had personal tenacity, which is reflected in her life and in her writings. She was a female who was vocal about her struggles in the 20th century. She was a female who had to cope and had to struggle with the typical 20th century struggles. She was the writer of hymns of hope and faith, and she lived a life of hope and faith. At this time, I am done with the presentation. If there are any questions or comments, we can take those now.
What's your favorite Margaret Clarkson?
My favorite? And why? I would probably have to say either God of the Ages, which is included on the handout, or O Father, You Are Sovereign. O Father, You Are Sovereign was actually her favorite text that she'd written. Of all her texts, it was her favorite. She recorded that in a singing heart. But probably O Father, You Are Sovereign, or God of the Ages. God of the Ages. God of the Ages? Why? I love God of the Ages. Just it's simple. It's so simple, and it is so profound. It takes a lot of the elements of Margaret's understanding of God's sovereignty, and yet it combines them all in a childlike simplicity that is very, very profound. Where do I see her legacy of writing and hymns continue today? That's a very difficult question. It depends partly on what tradition you would see her in. I think if you see her within the gospel song tradition, you probably could point to the Geddes and writers such as the Geddes as sort of a continuation of that tradition. But I'm not sure. I don't know for sure. I would tend to point that way, but any other questions, comments? Yes.
Yeah. Those are her words. Those are her exact words.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
You've given us a really in-depth picture of her, the kind of human picture, which a biographer can do, and that's very wonderful. Thanks.
Sure. Any other questions, comments? Thank you for coming. Have a good day.